Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 778, November the 3rd, 1986. I will begin the program by mentioning two documents that are locked up in the National Archives that pertain to what Jack Ruby was trying to say at his trial. He was tried for killing Lee Harvey Oswald. And for all we know, these commission documents are still not available. One is titled Fascists and Nazis Today by Alban Michael from Paris. It is labeled document number 1093. The other, that I can't pronounce so well, is called the Bundesnachrichtendienst file, whatever that means, document 597. Now, Jack Ruby smuggled letters out of the jail, and he spoke at his trial that Nazis and fascists were behind the Kennedy murder. And to hear the Warren Report talk about his paranoia, they didn't use those words. Jack Ruby at his trial said Nazis and fascists that killed John Kennedy. And Ruby, according to one archive statement or document, said was more knowledgeable about the conspiracy than most. And most people don't refer to a conspiracy in Dallas. A few people do, but Ruby was more knowledgeable. Now, at the time of Ruby's trial, that took place September 9th, 1965, a Judge Lewis Holland had persons surrounding Jack Ruby, trying to stop him from giving his opinion about the Kennedy assassination. And according to one document, Ruby disregarded his lawyers who were telling him to be quiet. And he said there was a conspiracy in high places behind the Kennedy assassination. Various news reports related, he said people in high places suppressed information about Oswald, and that he knew, and as he said, these microphones were pushed away from his face, and he objected. He said, the world has a right to hear the truth, that Oswald knew Kennedy was coming to Dallas even before Kennedy knew it, and that newsmen should search in high sources of political government to find out how Oswald got the job at the depository on the motorcade route. Now, the week of November 22nd, the 22nd anniversary of the murder of John Kennedy, there's going to be a three-part television series put on by Vincent Bugliosi, the famous prosecutor of the Manson trial, and an attorney representing the interests of Lee Oswald, who believes Oswald was guilty, even though he's representing him. But one of the real live witnesses out of all this fiction is going to be Ruth Payne, the lady who got Oswald the job at the Texas School Depository. And Ruth Payne's husband worked for Walter Dornberger, that famous Nazi war criminal who, according to the author of Project Paperclip, found documents that the British wanted to hang him at Nuremberg, that he would be a threat to world peace and to, you know, helping stir up a World War III type of activity. Michael Payne was a third-generation Harvard physicist who worked for Dornberger. Oswald stayed at their home. So in a few weeks, you will see the real Ruth Payne, and I'll do more about her later. But Jack Ruby said, go into this matter and look into these people because Nazis and fascists were behind the Kennedy murder. And as I say, two books on Nazis and fascism linked to Jack Ruby are locked up in the National Archives. Larry King had Lyndon LaRouche on the air this week on TV, and I called into the program. Some of you might have heard it, recognized the Carmel in my voice, and I asked Lyndon LaRouche why he publishes so much investigative work of a fairly high caliber and employs persons of the Ku Klux Klan to be part of his security team and to work for him, such as Mr. Frankhauser and these top Klan people. And LaRouche, and I had a two-part question. Would you explain to Larry King who Fritz Kramer is and why we never see him? Well, LaRouche said that the people who infiltrated the Klan weren't Klansmen themselves, that they were from the Central Intelligence Agency, which tells you that Lyndon LaRouche is using as part of his security members of the Central Intelligence Agency. Then he went on to say that Fritz Kramer, the former mentor of Henry Kissinger, allegedly retired now, is, in quotes, the most protected person in the Pentagon. And he went on to say that he has influenced many of our policies. Now, as a protege of Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger is still floating around, kicking a lot of ass and causing a lot of problems. A subscriber to World Watchers sent me a picture of Fritz Kramer that was in New Solidarity, Lyndon LaRouche's paper, August 27, 1981. That was 5 years ago. And it's titled, Faceless Fritz Kramer Found at Pentagon. Administration officials appear to be uncertain as to whether Fritz Kramer, the oligarchical-minded gentleman pictured here, has returned to the Pentagon from his retirement. This was in 1981 when Reagan was in power and was inaugurated January 81. And by August, they believed he was back in power. The article says, from his obscure 20-year post at the Pentagon, Kramer made the careers of both Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. According to reports, Kramer has been occupying a post in Undersecretary Fred Ickley's office in the Defense Department for the past month. And Fred Ickley has been fighting the Star Wars prohibitions, people not wanting the Star Wars. He's defending them. And Kramer shares offices with Daniel Graham of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who's behind Star Wars and High Frontier. As of 1981, he was in Fred Ickley's office in the Defense Department, right at the point where his protégés are preparing to assume emergency rule by decree over the United States. And, of course, in March 81, when the president was shot, Alexander Haig, his protégé, was saying, I'm in charge. And at the time of Watergate, he literally took over as head of the White House staff. The paper goes on, administration sources have referred certain inquiries on policy matters to Kramer at the Office for Emergency Planning at the Defense Department, which is interesting, yet a Pentagon spokesman has denied the existence of any such department. And F.D. Kramer is listed on the apartment roster attached to International Security Affairs. Kramer's son, Sven, is on the job at the National Security Council. So there is a picture of him in the Pentagon in 1981, and he has a very important position, according to this, with the Defense Department that he, in quotes, came out of retirement. Now, last week on television, I caught the early news, and there was a picture of John DeLorean going to his trial in Detroit. And all of a sudden, the camera zoomed in on the question of the missing money that they're asking, where at least $12 million have gone, $12 million cash that was supposed to go into his motor car company. And for years I've been talking about the possibility that that cash went to Klaus Barbie to pay for the cocaine that DeLorean had when he was photographed and arrested a few years ago. Well, all of a sudden the camera zoomed in to a bank vault, allegedly, in Switzerland and photographed box 33. And I don't recall ever seeing a camera in a Swiss bank vault, but the thing that came to my mind was that Fritz Kramer, Adolf Hitler's Fritz Kramer, was number 33 when he was released from Dachau prison. And for all purposes, no one in the world has seen him since, and I believe he jumped the ocean, came to our Defense Department, and began to run it as soon as he was released by Senator Joe McCarthy, along with Otto Skorzeny and then Klaus Barbie. These top Nazis began working for the United States immediately, and the similarity of the box number that was zoomed in for no reason at all, but as I said, I've never seen this before, and I identify with Fritz Kramer, number 33. There are connections between all these characters, and I don't think it was coincidental to just see a picture of that box that allegedly was the Swiss account of DeLorean. Now, some articles about Mr. Danloff, I don't want to brush them off because he's still too important, the summit's too important, but I just want to mention them quickly and go into more detail later, and some of them are self-explanatory. There's a cartoon in the paper the past week of Reagan sitting with his chief of staff who's reading him this message. It says, the Russians are still muffed because you wouldn't give up SDI. They want Danloff back. And a story from the LA Times, written by Robert C. Toth, went this way. This was just last week. An angry Reagan was the catalyst for spy ouster. The expulsion of the diplomats was a culmination of his campaign against the Soviets because of his embarrassment. The article says he was embarrassed at being forced to negotiate with Moscow for the freedom of U.S. journalist Nicholas Danloff. And he was grim over the failure of the Iceland summit that played a crucial role in his decision to expel Soviet, in quote, spies. It was Reagan who was under this torrent, according to the article, this terrible torrent of anger and frustration that he swept aside all the rules and began to cut diplomats, and they cut back and so forth. But the word here is forced to negotiate. because when Danilov was arrested, it only took 3 days for Ronald Reagan to have letters going to the Soviet Union. And as I did 2 broadcasts just on that question, he was desperate. Now, why was he forced to negotiate and then forced to go to the summit, and then he lets off his steam later? How important, again, is Danilov? And I've told you on the other broadcast, I think he's very important. But it's interesting that the LA Times is writing out that the president was forced within days to make a deal of some kind to get Danilov out. Several other articles of interest along those lines. Soviets dispute Reagan's Iceland position. Once he was forced to go to the table, what did they say or what didn't they say? And I compared it, I mentioned Stephen Sondheim's song about the treaty house. Another article in the San Jose Mercury, October 28th. United States-Soviets fuel dispute over Iceland talks. What was said? Would they eliminate nuclear weapons? Wouldn't they? And there was a request for some papers from Larry Speaks on what they really said, and he said you can't have them. October the 15th, LA Times, Speaks won't discuss off-the-record policy on the record. The White House announced yesterday that all interviews about President Reagan's Iceland meeting with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev will be on the record, but then reneged on the policy and said, you may never see these. It is a historic meeting. We won't tell you what they said. Another story by Norman Kempster, October 22nd. The scope of action of the United States baffles some analysts. And this was the process of sending certain Russians from this country, expelling them from the Soviet Union here to here, taking away the workers there, sending more out from here. The people in the State Department and analysts were baffled. What is going on? And one person is saying that Reagan is doing it out of anger because he was forced to make the deal on Danilov. Jean Kirkpatrick wrote an article, summit proposals surprise the Allies. Their concern is less that the sweeping agreements fell through than that some of them were considered at all. So there was something that the Soviet Union had that Ronald Reagan didn't want known about Gorbachev, and they got this meeting together quickly, and even an inner person like Jean Kirkpatrick can't figure it out. Then Henry Kissinger, of course, has a syndicated column regularly in most of the newspapers. There are a lot of them, and his is titled, Fundamental Agreements Do Not Happen Overnight. Well, they didn't get together overnight to have fundamental agreements, I'm sure. There was something they talked about. It's top secret. Nobody will know. But while they were meeting, the team, along with Henry Kissinger, like Mr. Poindexter and Vernon Walters and Richard Pipes and Richard Pearl and John Lehman and Michael Ledeen and Alexander Haig and Zbigniew Brzezinski, were all saturating the air, George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger, to make sure that they sabotaged or sent the president a message. So while he had a meeting for a few days with the head of the Soviet Union, the other team frantically was sinking the ship, whatever it was, locking up the notes, and just explaining, the anger and frustration that the president went through to even have to go through those things. And speaking of Henry Kissinger's article, you might have seen the lawsuit they placed today against Penthouse magazine. He had an interview that he thought was with a press person he didn't think would be in Penthouse, and the attorney representing Henry Kissinger is Simon Rifkin. Rifkin was the attorney for TCI, for Otto von Bolschwing's organization, for the Galen organization, and he also representing TCI and setting up the corporate papers that covered Helene von Damm, who was secretary and translator for that group. This was the Nazi Galen operation in the United States formed by members of the SS that worked for the OSS, and their attorney was Simon Rifkin, and staying with good fellow Nazis, he also is now representing Henry Kissinger, and like Roy Cohn and some of these other persons, Rifkin is Jewish, but that has nothing to do with their affiliation with Hitler's chief of intelligence of the East or West or the SS. They feel very comfortable working with those people and putting them into power. So Kissinger has Simon Rifkin for his attorney. The story I had about Danilov and his being mentioned in Mark Lane's book, Codenamed Zorro, is interesting because after I told you on the broadcast, after talking to Don Fried and Mark Lane, Mark Lane went ahead and wrote a long article for Spotlight. He's the attorney for Willie Cardo, another good Nazi, titled Danilov, Spy or Journalist with a question mark, as if he couldn't be both. Mark Lane knows that, and he probably is one himself. And it's called, titled under that, Crucial Aspect of the Story Ignored. And then he wrote a long, long article on how Danloff tried to put a wedge into the vote for the creation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And all of that was material that I had on my broadcast and that I had to tell Mark Lane that was in his book. Danloff's going to write a book and get a huge six-figure or more amount. In his U.S. News and World Report, there's a picture of him waving his hat. 13 days in a KGB prison. That was the October 13 issue. You'd really think that he was like these hostages that spent 1 or 2 years in prison. He's become such a hero, and he was actually locked up for a short time and then was out on his own recognizance, but 13 days was as much as he could get, and that would draw you a six-figure book or maybe $1 million. As far as a missing Israeli, Mordecai Vanunu, who broke the story about Israel having the neutron bomb, and I don't think the atomic bomb was as explosive as having the neutron, just breaking that story 3 weeks after the Cameroon explosions, he's still missing. There isn't a sign of him. A lot of articles, Cleric, that's one of his friends, fails to find Israeli technician, and they're looking for this missing technician. I don't know if he's alive in Israel being interrogated or whether they've killed him, but this person, the scientist that worked for Israel, has been gone now for a month, and there's not a trace of him. Speaking of neutron bombs, John Singlaub's name is in the news, associated with the funds for the Contras, in almost every article after the first day that the plane was down. Many of you know the confrontation that President Carter had with General Singlaub when he was in Korea in 1977. Jimmy Carter wanted to bring Singlaub home, and he did. He successfully got him out of the army because Singlaub criticized Carter's decision to reduce the troops that were in South Korea. That decision was reversed, and the military kept their troops. But the New York Times has a story October 8th. After being transferred to another position, General Singlaub criticized President Carter again, that time for deciding not to produce a neutron bomb. It was then that he was asked to resign from the military. So as soon as Carter was out and Ronald Reagan was in, we made the neutron bomb, and Reagan was sending Alexander Haig, the protege of Fritz Kramer, to Europe with the CIA to sell the idea of the neutron bomb. Haig worked very, very closely with the Mossad, Israeli intelligence, and as I say, the scandal over there is the Cameroon neutron bomb explosion that will eventually work its way up into the media if a few good writers or scientists get on it. So far, they're sitting on that story. I spent a good deal of World Watchers this past year on the Challenger explosion that took place January 28th and did many, many broadcasts. You might have seen the articles this week. Former NASA whistleblower Richard Cook said he asked Attorney General Edwin Meese to consider a new investigation into the shuttle Challenger accident, and he once appointed a special prosecutor, not from the White House or Meese, to conduct it. Cook is a budget analyst for the Treasury Department. He said NASA officials perceived pressure from the White House to launch January 28th because President Reagan was planning to deliver his State of the Union address that night. Now, this information I had on KGO that same evening, and it is almost a year later, and a person involved in NASA said that the White House has denied involvement, but the Rogers Commission will not get the tapes, and he's asked the Attorney General to put a special prosecutor onto the case because he believes that the White House ordered the launching knowing they didn't know that those people would be killed, but the NASA officials gave into the White House, and the NASA officials knew that it couldn't go safely in that cold weather. And he also is accusing the Rogers Commission of hiding this work. The New York Times has a story, ex-NASA aide assails the work of the Challenger panel. Well, I said that William Rogers, the attorney, is a mafia lawyer. At the time, he was being questioned for a $40 million fine that he had to pay his law office to Jay Dominelli in San Diego. That was only the fine for having worked for somebody selling fraudulent stock. At the time, he knew it was fraudulent. William Rogers is a partner with William Casey of the CIA. So there have been quite a few articles about urging a special prosecutor and how William Rogers covered this up. And, of course, he was getting himself off some kind of prosecutions, even though he paid a deep fine. At the time, he was working on the Rogers Commission, and they never were expected to go into the story of the temperature and the White House and the pressure. Now, a very important person was arrested in Las Vegas this past week. This is the lead article of the story, Death Threats Led to Arrest of Extremist. It has to do with a former Army colonel who is one of the heads of the Posse Comitatus. He was arrested with three people with a California branch of their organization. They're being held without bond. They were allegedly planning to engage in paramilitary training near Fresno, California, with emphasis on night ambushes, knife fighting, and garroting. The indictment alleges the training was linked to death threats. William P. Gale, 69, was arrested last week in Mariposa, along with Fortunato Parina. The others were arrested in Las Vegas and Flagstaff. A date of December 15th is set for conspiracy, mailing a threat, communications, aiding and abetting, attempting to interfere with the IRS. And this goes into Mr. Gill's tapes. He has tape recordings and sermons. He tells you how to cut throats, how to kill blacks. He wants to cut the throats of Jews in this country. Gale, this is the Army officer, Army colonel, is a former colonel who served on General Douglas MacArthur's staff in World War II. He was considered an expert in guerrilla warfare. He served the Army until 1950. Now, I have a lot of articles on Gale, and I've done broadcasts on Gale. And as head of the Posse Comitatus, one of the most extreme right-wingers in the country, he has been arrested, and they said he calls himself the Reverend. He puts a collar around his neck, and he becomes a Reverend. And he makes these sermons and cassettes that were played in Kansas City, how to attack Jews and minorities and how to kill them. Gale was never arrested before, and it was John Hinckley, who was a member of the California Posse Comitatus, who was at my house in January 1983, and the license of the car that he had belonged to a member of the Posse Comitatus when he was floating around this state. John Hinckley, the fellow that took shots at Ronald Reagan in March of 81. It was January of 81 when Hinckley was parked in front of my house and wanted to rent a room at the house. Now, I'll go back to William Potter Gale later, because Gale not only worked with the staff of Douglas MacArthur and with Charles Willoughby, the graduate of Adolf Hitler's Kriegsakademie, but he also knew Dr. Loyal Davis in the Philippines, who had come visit there. And the family of Nancy Reagan, she took on her stepfather's name, Davis, is linked to Gale and Douglas MacArthur and the far, far right who were calling Eisenhower communist. This is the John Birch, the World Anti-Communist League, the China Lobby Group that evolved out of Japan, with organized crime war criminals from World War II and from the Philippines, the MacArthur Asian crowd, and John Singlaub, who's involved with wanting to push neutron bombs, among other things, who's funding the Contras, comes out of that milieu of South Korea, Vietnam, and these were the assassination teams that went on later that all worked together with the CIA, the OSS, and formed the network of people who could eliminate candidates that were in the way of their getting particular people, such as Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, into the White House. So the arrest of Gale this week is very important. Also, there's been a trial going down in Los Angeles on the two women who ran a nursery school, Charlotte Ruth Wyckoff, 52 years old, and Elizabeth Lita Hamilton. And they have been, they had a plea of guilty for firebombing, trying to firebomb the home of two other teachers. They may face a maximum sentence of 20 years or up to $375,000. I don't think they'll do that. But they brought to California Franklin Camper, the fellow who runs the mercenary school, and not separate from Reverend Gale either. These gangs all work together. Camper ran the school that trained the Sikhs that allegedly were involved with blowing up the Air India and also killing two people in Japan that worked with an airline going to India. The sentencing of Camper, I believe, is going to take place tomorrow, Tuesday, so by the time any of you get these tapes, you may read in the newspaper. But Camper has been locked up in the clink along with a lot of other people, Mr. Falk, and a Hedgecourt, and they will get some kind of sentence, and that will keep him out of business for a while, not for the right reasons, but what he did was pretty bad, and so he's put away. As I say, the ladies have already pleaded guilty, so if they're guilty, then Camper will be guilty also, and it will temporarily slow down some of his activities. Also, the New York Times had an article, October 22nd, unauthorized genetic field test criticized, and I'll go into advanced genetic sciences later and update you on the progress of these new technologies, the altering of genes, and there was a slap on the wrist for going ahead with the genetic field tests ahead of time. They didn't get the approval. Nation magazine finally got into the AGS question. Regulating altered genes from ICE9 to ICE-. This is Nation magazine, October 25th, and it begins a new presidential policy directive regulating the development and release into the environment of products of biotechnology, was signed by Ronald Reagan June 18th, that greatly relaxes restrictions on what environmentalists see as an already dangerously unregulated industry, underregulated. Well, the person working in the White House for the science division, as I stated before, is Mr. Graham, who was in charge of NASA at the time the shuttle program was exposed for many of the faults that it has and for ordering the Challenger to go up that terrible morning and consequently blow up. Graham moved into the White House with Ronald Reagan and then immediately linked up with a board of directors member from Harvard of Advanced Genetic Sciences, and the connections to Sweden and Belgium and the international links to this bacteria have to be developed because a lot of people don't realize the international implications of what is happening to our lives and bodies. But this article goes on with the lawsuits of Jeremy Rifkin and the attempt to stop the altered genes being put in our environment, but Ronald Reagan gives it the go-ahead. Now, one other article I'll share with you before I get to the Nicaragua subject for the second half of this program. The London Times has a story, French Panic Over the Nazi Files. This is October the 12th. 10 tons of files are difficult to mislay, particularly when the meticulous record, a subject as tender as the relationship between the Nazi Gestapo and French collaborators during the Nazi occupations, is involved. But all France now is agog over a claim that files have recently been found years after the war ended. Last week, Colonel Pellel Belhold, the head of the counter-espionage in France at the end of the war, poured scorn over the fact that these files have been found. The files are a distressing discovery of treachery and cowardice of people who now hold respected positions in French life. And what is happening in France, the expose of people in prominence now, the files show their works with Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime during World War II, just as it's 22 years since John Kennedy was murdered, and many of the people involved, a good many of them who murdered him and who covered up the murder, are holding prominent positions and places in the State Department, in the Defense Department, in the White House, who were part of the murders and the coup that we had here, which is part of the linkage to Klaus Barbie and the Nazis of France. The international fascista links directly to our assassinations and to the P2 in Europe and to Otto Skorzeny and Henry Kissinger and Klaus Barbie. This mesh of fascism has not ended. It was continuous, and those people who did these things moved up in power to have more power. The London Times says most of the Gestapo and the Abwehr, that's German intelligence files, were thought to have been taken to Germany and destroyed in 3 weeks after France was liberated in August of 1944. Colonel Pellel is confident that his men tracked down the residue in France on German vehicles that were abandoned in their retreat and in the Third Reich as it was defeated itself. At the end of the war, enough evidence had been gathered to charge 4,598 French men and women for espionage and treason. 56 were condemned to death. Colonel Pellel's Service-20 group worked at slackening the pace until the 1950s, and all suspected cases were supposedly dealt with by that time. Now comes the Demaranche 10-ton bomb. There is already a clamor for the files to be made public. The French Defense Minister André Giraud said that the files, assuming they exist, should be transferred to his ministry for detailed examination. He has not decided whether any skeletons should be revealed. A commission, which represents the old resistance groups, will recommend to him what to do. The files would be valuable fodder for Maître Verge, that's Jacques Verge, the attorney for Klaus Barbie, the flamboyant attorney, who will defend the Gestapo officer Barbie in a trial expected to start early next year. That's 4 years since he was arrested. Barbie was extradited from Bolivia, that's in January of 83. Now we're going on to 1987. Verge said his client could not have done his work so well without French help. He will seize on the new evidence in the files to draw attention to the French collusion with the Gestapo. So they have now found 10 tons of files of current people in French life that worked with Klaus Barbie and the Gestapo. And the London Times, October 21st, has this story, French Panic Over the Nazi Files. In this country, if we opened up our national archives, our heads of states would panic the same way because of the role of so many in the murder of the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King and a lot of other people. We'll take a one-minute break and then go on to the Nicaraguan airplane incident, which could take every week for the next year. We wouldn't even scratch it.